Welcome to the Dark Things Podcast. This is Season 3, Episode 10, our finale episode on D.B. Cooper. Today's episode sounds like something out of an action movie. We talk about robbing the U.S. government, hijacking a plane, holding hostages, and of course a parachute jump that could rival any Hollywood stunt. Who was the supposed badass allegedly named Dan Cooper? Today we are discussing the infamous D.B. Cooper and how this still unsolved FBI case haunts the government today.
All right, yeah, so as Andrew's been saying, we've been excited to do this topic for a while.
Yeah.
I didn't really know much about D.B. Cooper until, like, just a year ago. You didn't know anything about him, right, until today, right, Andrew?
Well, when we previously talked about it, like, when we were planning this episode, I think that was the first time we talked about it, about, like, 2 months ago. But I didn't know who he was until we had brought it up, you know?
Yeah, so I actually watched a documentary on, I think it was just one of those, like, low-grade Amazon documentaries. And I just thought, wow, this guy is a badass. we got to do a show on this. So it's not especially dark, I would say, but it's action packed and it's a really interesting topic. So
for sure. So let's get started with the story. On Thanksgiving Eve, nonetheless, 1971, a middle-aged man carrying a black briefcase approached the ticket counter of Northwest Orient Airlines at Portland International Airport. He identified himself as Dan Cooper and used cash to purchase a one-way ticket on Flight 305, a 30-minute trip north to Seattle. Cooper boarded the aircraft, a Boeing 727, and took seat 18C in the rear of the passenger cabin. Cooper was a quiet man who appeared to be in his mid-40s, wearing a business suit with a black tie and white shirt. He ordered a drink, bourbon, and soda, while the flight was waiting to take off.
Was it shaken or stirred?
That's the question, because if it wasn't shaken, we know it's not James Bond.
Yeah, right. This story is like, it sounds like it could be a James Bond movie, honestly.
Oh, easy. Like with that black, oof, just imagine that black, you know, tie with that white shirt.
Sure.
Gets the ladies going.
Also, side question, have you ever had bourbon and soda before?
No, that sounds gross.
It sounds really nasty.
No, what is it, like vermouth? That's the one that like grosses me out.
That's like the wine, right? It's like a really fermented
wine.
Oh, wait.
Actually, my bad. It's not vermouth. What's the drink where you mix vermouth with, I think, vodka or gin? Yeah, I think it's gin and vermouth.
I don't know, but it sounds awful.
Yeah, my girlfriend's a waitress, so she talks about drinks like this all the time. But yeah, there's legit a drink where they do vermouth with like gin.
So do you want to know the best drink, in my opinion, my honest personal opinion?
Let's hear it.
The best drink to have on an airplane?
What?
Gin and tonic.
Wait, is that what it is? What's gin and tonic? That sounds like what I'm talking about.
Gin and tonic, like a club soda type. I mean, it's not club soda, but it's a tonic. So
just like carbonated water, right?
With ice. And maybe a splash of lime if they have it. Some airlines don't do that, like fresh lime, but
that doesn't sound bad.
It's really refreshing.
When I do drink, I honestly do drink whiskey straight on the rocks.
Mm-hmm.
Literally my favorite. It's just like, I don't know. I know people think it's gross. I know people think beer is gross, but like it's an acquired
beer
taste.
Beer is disgusting, in my opinion.
I think it's an acquired taste though, because it's like a sour bitter flavor. And like, I definitely didn't like that shit when I was younger, but I'm starting to get into it, you know?
Wine too, also acquired.
Yes. Yep. And I barely started getting into that like 2 years ago. But
It's true. But and this is also a side note. Everything tastes differently when you're in the air. Like it has something to do with your taste buds. I heard this thing on it. But gin and tonic, there's just something about it. It's like so refreshing. So next time you're on an airplane, try gin and tonic.
Dude, wait.
It'll change your life.
Okay, explain what you mean. Like when you're in the air, it tastes different. Like it just your taste buds
your
will
taste
actually
buds
perceive it. Different?
Actually perceive things differently at 30,000 feet in the air.
Like better, right?
It's just different. It's actually I heard that it's a little more bland. That's why people always make fun of airplane food. It's not necessarily the food itself, but everything has a different taste when you're that high up in the air. That makes sense.
Dude, that's so crazy.
Yeah.
How's food taste in space then? That's what I want to know.
Right? Who knows? But it's true, though. Like, in all of the years of flying I've done, it's true. I've noticed it.
Hell yeah.
So try it next time.
I'm interested now. Fuck.
All right. So back to D.B. Cooper. He ordered his bourbon and soda. Flight was awaiting takeoff in Portland. It was Northwest Orient Flight 305. It was approximately one-third full. It departed Portland on schedule at 2:50 p.m. Shortly after takeoff, Cooper handed a note to Florence Schaffner, who was a flight attendant situated nearest to him in the jump seat, attached to the aft stair door. Schaffner, assuming the note contained a lonely businessman's phone number, dropped it into her unopened purse. Cooper leaned toward her and whispered, "Miss, you better look at that note. I have a bomb."
Dude. What a badass. Like, first of all, like, just the audacity just to straight up say.
Dude, the audacity that she didn't even look at the note.
Dude, yeah, fuck this bitch.
That's some audacity, right?
Women don't treat men like anything, bro. Women ain't shit.
Oh, my God.
I want man's rights.
We're not going down. Although, we did look at our listener analytics today, and it's like 70% men.
Yeah.
30% women. So, women, you got to crank it up.
Yeah, seriously. We need more women in here.
Mm-hmm.
Freaking turning.
But, you know, that kind of talk, Andrew, is not going to get us very many... It's not going to get us popular,
bro,
with the women.
Okay, like, I'm a feminist, bro. I'll say it right now.
You're going to burn shit down?
No, dude, I'm a teacher, bro. I work in a feminine position,
you're right.
Feminine field. I know what they go through, to an extent. Yeah. To an extent, I obviously don't understand.
All respect
everything.
To women, seriously.
Yeah.
But anyways, yeah, so she just, and you know, she probably got hit on a ton being a flight attendant, especially back in the 70s when they were wearing, like, you know, like skirts way, way up. You know?
Yeah, based on that video we saw.
Yeah, have you seen 70s flight attendants? I mean, it's crazy, dude. Like, their uniforms, like Southwest.
They dressed them like hookers.
Yeah, they really did. They had, like, go-go boots on and stuff.
Oh, my God.
I mean, it's just crazy.
Just,
so,
you got to satisfy the patriarchy, you know? That's
back in the 70s, that was for sure. And now they're, like, you know, they all wear, like, turtlenecks up to here, and they're all 80 years old, you know?
Dude, I'm curious, though, because it says that her purse, I like how it says she dropped the note into her unopened purse. Like, are we just talking about, like, a flap on the outside, like a little pocket, or is she just, like, fuck this note?
I don't know. But I just think it's funny. It's like, miss, you better look at that note. I have a bomb. But like, out of all of the airlines and like routes to hijack a plane, this would probably be the worst route to hijack a plane because you're flying from Portland to Seattle.
Yeah.
That's like a 30, 45 minute flight.
Nothing.
Yeah. So he was probably like, hey,
let's get the shit going.
Come on. Like the pilot's ready to land and she still hasn't even opened the note. He's like, oh,
he's like, I don't got time for this. Yeah.
So the note was printed in all capital letters with a felt tip pen. Its exact wording is unknown because Cooper later reclaimed the note. But Schaffner recalled that the note said that Cooper had a bomb in his briefcase. After Schaffner read the note, Cooper told her to sit beside him. Schaffner did as requested, then quietly asked to see the bomb. Would you do that? Like, can I see the bomb?
I mean, if I was scared shitless in this scenario, I'd be like, yeah, is he joking or is he not? Because
yeah,
you might as well, you know,
that's
be
true.
Like, all
but
right.
Still, though, I wouldn't even want him to touch it because, like, one little bump of that thing, you never know.
True. But also, like, 70s technology, like, I bet that shit wasn't, like,
yeah,
you literally had to push a button, probably.
Yeah. And so when he finally did open the briefcase to show Schaffner, the flight attendant, he opened it long enough for her to glimpse at 8 red cylinders. It was a 4 on top, 4 on the bottom. And she said it was dynamite, and it was attached to wires coated with red insulation and a large cylindrical battery. After closing the briefcase, he stated his demands, $200,000 in negotiable American currency.
Nice.
So whatever that means, but negotiable American currency. And when I was looking at the conversion of $200,000, it was like just barely over $1 million at this time. So just, I mean, he's not that greedy, you know? Like a million? Like, if I'm going to hijack a plane and risk my life and, like, freedom forever, I'm going to ask for at least, you know?
Yeah.
100 million.
But also with, like, I don't know, maybe to an extent, if he's only asking for that much, like, I wonder how much that, like, gets the feds involved, right? Because obviously the feds are involved. You're going to have, like, people flying, like, obviously trying to take him out. But, like, if it's a reasonable amount, they might not take him as seriously. I wonder if that was, like, a part of it, you know? Because, like, a million's a good amount of money, you know?
That's
like,
true.
Anyone could live off that. Okay.
And another thing we need to talk about is what he's planning to do with the money.
Yeah.
Because if he's asking for, well, we'll get into that. We'll keep reading.
Yeah, for sure. So let's see. Did you finish that paragraph all the way?
Yeah. So $200,000 in negotiable American currency, 4 parachutes, and a fuel truck standing by in Seattle to refuel the aircraft upon its arrival. Schaffner conveyed Cooper's instructions to the pilots in the cockpit. When she returned, Cooper was wearing dark sunglasses.
So we're saying he didn't have the sunglasses on before, and then he puts them on after hours. He's like, fuck you guys. So just fucking glasses on.
Or maybe he just forgot, you know? He's like, oh shit, like, I need to put these on. And he meant to put them on earlier.
Oh shit, that's true. But with how, like, relaxed he was with, like, getting his bourbon, just
I don't think this guy made any mistakes, to be honest. No. Like, this seems like it was seamless.
I almost wonder, I think the sunglass move was just to be a badass. He was probably just like, all right, here we go.
Pull those shades up.
My status is above every peon on earth right now.
For real. He's like, okay, all right. Things are going my way.
For real. So we got the pilot, William A. Scott, who contacted Seattle Tacoma Airport, air traffic control, which in turn informed local and federal authorities that the 35 other passengers were given false information that their arrival in Seattle would be delayed because of a minor mechanical difficulty. Northeast Orient's president, Donald Nerup, authorized payment of the ransom and ordered all employees to cooperate fully with the hijackers' demands. The aircraft circled Seattle-Tacoma Airport for approximately 2 hours to allow Seattle police and the FBI sufficient time to assemble Cooper's parachutes and ransom money, and to mobilize emergency personnel. The FBI carefully collected the ransom money in the form of $20 bills and recorded the serial number for each bill.
So the fact that the FBI gave him this money and they're collecting the money in $20 bills, like, imagine how many $20 bills that must have been.
Yeah.
We're talking like a massive duffel bag of heavy, heavy money. Like, it probably weighed, I mean, minimum 50 pounds, don't you think?
Yeah. Well, and it's like, they definitely had access to $100 bills, you know? So this is purposeful. Like, I'm wondering, they probably, like, definitely thought this out, you know? Like, jumping out of a plane with that many $20 bills, like, how are you going to fall with that shit? It's going to make you fall faster.
It's going to weigh you down. It's going to weigh you down. Yeah. You're right. So, and recording the serial number, I also want to take emphasis on that, because that plays a huge role in what happens after this, and kind of the mystery behind it. So, like I said, the reason why the pilots had to circle Seattle so much before they could land, because the FBI had to get the gear, they had to get all the money, and then they had to literally record every serial number on each $20 bill. And they probably had a machine that did it, but still, though, that's...
Yeah.
I mean, we're talking hundreds, maybe even, thousands of $20 bills.
But, I mean, that's what you got to do, right? Because this money is going to be unusable.
Yeah, like, it's going to be completely unusable. And, you know, I don't know if D.B. Cooper understood that or not.
Yeah, I bet he did. I bet he was just doing this for, like, the infamy, right?
You think?
Yeah, because, like, if he's putting on sunglasses, if he's dressing like a James Bond character, if he's getting bourbon.
So you think he's doing it for the thrill, not the money?
Dude, I honestly think this guy might have had, like, a personality disorder or actually, like, wanted to be James Bond.
He's just a mega narcissist, too, probably.
Yeah, definitely.
Like, he don't give an F about nothing.
No. Dude, because, like...
In Creed voice. He don't give an F about nothing.
He's literally, like, just... He's playing the part, you know?
Yeah, he like, totally that's creepy. He totally is. So at 5:24 p.m., Cooper was informed that his demands had finally been met. And at 5:39 p.m., the aircraft landed at Seattle-Tacoma Airport. It was more than an hour after sunset. Cooper instructed Scott, the pilot, to taxi the jet to an isolated, brightly lit section of the apron and to close each window shade in the cabin to deter police snipers. That's also really smart of him.
Yeah.
Dude, this would be like the craziest part, though, if you were him. Because you're like, you have to be so careful with your moves, you know? Because you know, like, the FBI's there, all the police are there.
Yeah.
Like, you're on the ground, you're super vulnerable. In the plane, not so much, but, like, he'd have to be super careful at this point.
Right.
So he instructed the pilot and the crew to close all the window shades in the cabin to deter the snipers. Northwest Orient Seattle Operations Manager Al Lee approached the aircraft in street clothes, and to avoid the possibility that Cooper might mistake his airline uniform for that of a police officer, he delivered the cash-filled knapsack. I love how they call it a knapsack. Like, this shit was probably massive. Like,
oh, yeah.
A huge duffel bag full of money. And parachute via the aircraft's aft stairs. Once the delivery was complete, Cooper ordered all the passengers, Schaffner, and senior flight attendant Alice Hancock to leave the plane. So I think right now the only people that were on the plane after it's refilled now is D.B. Cooper, one of the flight attendants, and both pilots.
Yeah.
At this point. So he told everybody to get off. So obviously he doesn't care that much about people's lives. You know, he's not doing it for that.
No. Yeah. I love how methodical he is. Like, he's definitely, he's thought this through, right? So.
Oh, absolutely. He's thought this through.
Yeah. Like, I don't know. This guy's a genius, bro. So during refueling, Cooper outlined his flight plan to the cockpit crew, a southeast course toward Mexico City at the minimum airspeed possible without stalling the aircraft. which is approximately 100 knots or 115 miles per hour at a maximum of 10,000 foot or 3,000 meters altitude. He further specified that the landing gear remained deployed in the taking off or landing position. The wing flaps be lowered 15 degrees and the cabin remain unpressurized. So before I continue that, do you want to go over like what this might all mean since you went to flight school?
For sure. So DB Cooper must have some type of background in aviation for him to know this, because when you order he knows the exact stalling speed of the aircraft is just 115 miles per hour, and that is slow. Yeah. I mean, for a jet, like a passenger liner jet, that is so slow, and that's borderline like fall out of the sky slow.
Are we talking like if it dropped to even 114, would it stall?
You know, like 115 is the minimum. You could probably get away with a few miles under.
Okay.
But at that point, your stall horn is going to go off when you're flying a plane. And when your stall horn goes off, it means you need to pick up speed ASAP by either pointing the nose down to pick up speed or increasing the throttle, because you will fall out of the sky at that point.
Goddamn.
I mean, you have to be going a minimum in order to not fall out of the sky. And then the maximum height of 10,000 foot altitude, which is 3,000 meters for our European friends. he specified that the landing gear remained deployed. That's another thing. You can't overspeed with landing gear down. It will really, like, it's really bad for the landing gear on the plane, and it also puts you in a really slow configuration. Especially the flaps as well. You're not going to want to go too fast when you have flaps down, because it's really just going to mess up like the entire configuration of the plane. And it's dangerous to fly high speeds with landing gear and flaps down. So, also the cabin unpressurized, because, you know, he's not flying at an altitude high enough for the plane to be pressurized. So the guy knows what he's doing. What I think happened, and the real reason why he wanted this whole configuration, is obviously it's pointing towards he's going to jump from the plane.
Yeah,
I mean, he has the parachutes. They called up the Air Force to follow this plane, and you know that he knows that's going to happen. And flying at that minimum speed of 115 miles an hour, no jet is going to be able to follow that. Like, no, I don't know what kind of, I think we talk about it later in the show, but I can't remember what time. Oh, two F-106 fighter aircraft were following this plane. So those planes would not be able to keep up. Like, they would have to keep circling the jet, if that makes sense. So they're not going to be able to just follow the 727.
Is there a reason they can't go that slow? Is it just like the fuel they're using, or is it just the engine?
It's just the type of engine. They physically, fighter jets cannot go that slow without stalling. Like, the 727 that they're flying in, it can go that slow without stalling, but jets cannot follow. You know, like when a police car follows a car, and he's just right behind him the whole entire pursuit? That's not going to happen with an airplane, because that jet is just going so fast it has to keep circling round and around and around. So when that jet's circling around, who knows when he's going to jump out of the plane? You know what I mean?
That's a good point. That makes more sense on how he basically got away.
So that's another reason I think that he wanted the plane to fly so low and so slow, because he didn't want these jets to be following and keeping an eye on the plane. Right. Also, it was super rainy that night too.
Right.
It's a rainy Thanksgiving night.
I am curious with all these preventative measures, with him asking for the landing gear to be down, the flaps to be down, the low speed and everything. Do you think that was more in line with him wanting to make sure he could jump, like to guarantee that the pilot didn't speed up the plane? Because obviously you're going to fuck the landing gear and everyone dies. Like, the pilot's not going to do that to himself. Or was he just doing that? I don't know. What do you think?
I think they were all fail-safe measures. I think that he definitely knew if that plane goes faster than 115 miles an hour, or, I mean, because if you're ever in an airplane and you pull up the outside speed and the outside temperature, I mean, the temperature outside when you're flying at 30,000 feet in the air is like negative 30 degrees.
Damn.
I mean, it's enough to, like, if you were to touch that air, it would freeze you, you know?
Yeah.
Whereas if he's flying only at 10,000 foot altitude, it's not nearly as cold. I mean, it's still really cold.
Yeah.
And there was freezing rain during this time. But, you know, the higher you go, the colder it gets when you get up in the atmosphere.
Right.
And I don't think he wanted to go that high because he would have died with how cold it was.
Okay. And also, if he was going faster, would it have been a guaranteed death or a chance of death, like significantly higher if he dropped at 115 miles per hour?
I don't think so. I think the suction would have been a lot worse. You know, like when you see movies of like planes depressurizing and people like flying out, I don't think it happens to that extent. But I think that if the plane was going super fast, like at its normal cruising speed and altitude, he wouldn't be able to get as controlled of a jump outside the plane.
That makes sense. Huh. Okay.
Because, I mean, 115, that's fast, but if he's jumping out this specific type of plane, which is a Boeing 727, there's these stairs in the back of the airplane that, because, I mean, if you just jump out of a normal door on a jet, you're going to, if it's above or forward of the engines, you're going to get sucked into the engine.
Right.
Whereas with this plane, I have a picture of it down there. You just lower these back stairs and you just hop right out.
So much easier.
Normal planes like 737s and the normal planes you see today don't have these back staircases.
Yeah.
But this back staircase was very unique to this plane, and I think that's what really helped him do the jump.
Okay. Makes sense. Okay. We'll get into that, I don't know, a little bit later, because especially with the aircrafts going around, we'll definitely revisit. Co-pilot William J. Radexac, who formerly served for the United States Air Force during the Korean War and Vietnam War, informed Cooper that the aircraft's range was limited to approximately 1,000 miles under the specified flight configuration, which meant that a second refueling would be necessary before entering Mexico. Cooper and the crew discussed options and agreed on Reno, Nevada, as the refueling stop. With the plane's rear exit door open and its staircase extended, Cooper directed the pilot to take off. Northwest Home Office objected on grounds that it was unsafe to take off with the aft staircase deployed. Cooper countered that it was indeed safe, but he would not argue the point. He would lower it once they were airborne. Interesting.
Yeah, so basically he wanted it to be lowered. So I guess this part of his plan didn't really work, because he wanted the pilots to take off with the staircase down.
Yeah.
But they're like, nah, you can't do that. It's way too unsafe. But I guess he finally agreed and he's like, all right, forget it.
So with that point, do you think he may have not been like super like aware of like aviation and stuff, but he may have been like thoughtful on how he was going to jump from the plane?
Yeah, I think for sure as they were about to take off, that would have been the main thing going through his mind of how he's going to jump from this plane, you know. But on most planes, there's a manual override for most everything. So I'm sure there was some type of manual override for this staircase to go down. So I'm sure it was that. So once an FAA official requested a face-to-face meeting with Cooper on board the aircraft, which was denied, like Andrew was saying, when they landed in Reno, he didn't want to meet with an FAA official. Once refueling had been completed, the plane was able to take off. Okay, so this was out of Seattle, actually. So they left Seattle, and at approximately 7:40 p.m., the Boeing 727 took off with only 5 people on board. Cooper, pilot Scott, flight attendant Mucklow, Captain Radazak, and flight engineer Harold Anderson. So flight engineer, that's basically way back in the day, there was always 3 people in the cockpit. And the flight engineer monitored all like the buttons and systems and stuff to make sure everything was good.
So he basically got rid of the...
It was basically just 3 pilots.
What are the flight attendants? Basically, when did they get off the plane? Was that here?
They got off
Reno?
In Seattle.
Okay.
They haven't got to Reno yet. But yeah, he kicked all the passengers off, all 35 passengers and the other flight attendants, and only kept 1 flight attendant and 3 pilots on board.
Okay.
So, and this is what we were talking about. 2 F-106 fighter aircraft were scrambled at McCord Air Force Base and followed behind the airliner, once above it and once below, one above it and one below the aircraft out of Cooper's view. A Lockheed T, should I repeat that?
Yeah.
Okay. 2 F-106 fighter aircraft were scrambled from McCord Air Force Base and followed behind the airliner, one above it and one below out of Cooper's view. A Lockheed T-33 also shadowed the 727 before running low on fuel and turning back to Oregon. Overall, there were 5 planes in total trailing the hijacked plane.
That's insane.
Yeah.
I mean, but like, also it's not realistic to have more because that'd be a safety issue with them flying that close, right?
Yeah.
Is that the most they could probably do?
Yeah. And I guarantee you the reason why they scrambled so many planes is like they're just saying, hey, we need to keep an eye on this plane because we know the guy's going to jump out of it at some point.
Right. Huh.
But like I said, this was a really dark and rainy night and none of the pilots, none of the Air Force pilots even saw him jump out of the plane.
Right.
Well, one of them might have seen the air stairs in the back go down, but I don't think they ever saw him. They never pinpointed the exact location where he jumped.
Right. Well, it's kind of interesting they specify that two of those F-106 aircrafts, because it wasn't the Lockheed T-33. I think that's the one that Cooper could have seen, but that they purposely placed the F-106 above and below the plane to where Cooper could not see them from the staircase, mm-hmm. which means that, like, could those pilots even realistically see, like, saw him if they were that far away?
Probably not.
Like, that's insane.
No.
What was the purpose, you know?
I don't think they would have. And I don't think they would have. If they're trying to stay out of sight, they're obviously not going to fly that close to the plane anyways.
Yeah.
Because he's going to hear it.
Oh, that's true, huh?
So okay. I doubt that they were that close. And, if I'm an Air Force pilot flying next to one of these planes and there's dynamite on board, I'm not going to get close to that thing.
No, fuck that. Yeah.
Hell no. If that thing blew up, I wouldn't want it, like, shrapnel and pieces of that plane hitting my plane.
Okay, I am curious with how they implemented this. Do you think it would have been more beneficial if they had the planes all flying below? So at least if they drop, they could possibly see him dropping below. And like not to be like graphic, but I mean, if he did drop, you know, he's dropping on planes below him.
I think that the weather at night, I've seen like in the documentary I watched, the weather was so bad, you couldn't get any visual on anything is what they were saying.
Okay.
So I think even following below the airplane would have been bad because if he did manage to jump and deploy his parachute, what would happen if your jet just slammed right into that, you know?
Oh, like, God.
Surprise. Guts and money everywhere, you know?
Sloppy
like,
Joe.
Yeah. And
Sloppy
your
Cooper.
Planes, and then your, yeah. And then your plane's kind of messed up because you now have all this shit all over it and, like, a parachute on it, you know? So I don't know if their goal was to, like, follow the plane to follow, like, find out when he jumped or to make sure it didn't, like, pull like a 9/11, you know?
Oh, God.
And crash into something and use it as a weapon, which in the 70s, still pretty new using airplanes as a weapon, but not unheard of.
Right. Know? Well, I guess, yeah, with that time period, they're probably super freaked out about it. This isn't like, yeah. Not 9/11.
But, you know, even post 9/11, people would lose their minds if this happened.
Yeah, definitely.
Post 9/11, it's pretty much impossible to hijack a plane.
Yeah.
Like, you can't. Yeah. I mean, I'm not going to say it's impossible.
Well, it's like, wasn't
because of MH370. You remember that?
That's true. That was an anomaly. With, what are the guys that sit on the plane with guns? They're basically
Air Marshal.
Yeah, because that wasn't a thing until after 9/11, right?
No.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a thing now.
After takeoff, Cooper told Mucklow to join the rest of the crew in the cockpit. Is Mucklow the engineer?
Mucklow is the flight attendant.
Flight attendant. Okay. So Mucklow is to join the rest of the crew in the cockpit and remain there with the door closed. As she complied, Mucklow observed Cooper tying something around his waist at approximately 8 o'clock p.m. A warning light flashed in the cockpit, indicating that the aft air staff apparatus had been activated. The crew's offer of assistance via the aircraft's intercom system was certainly refused. The crew soon noticed a subjective change of air pressure, indicating that the aft door was open. At approximately 10:15 p.m., the aircraft's air aft stair was still deployed when Scott and Radizak landed the 727 at Reno Airport. FBI agents, state troopers, sheriff deputies, and the Reno police surrounded the jet, as it had not yet been determined that Cooper was no longer aboard. But an armed search quickly confirmed his disappearance.
He did it. That crazy son of a bitch, he did it.
He fucking did it.
That's crazy, honestly. Well, like,
with that video we were watching before we started recording this, what was it like? He would have dropped out at the equivalent of like -69 degrees, mm-hmm. because of the rain,
mm-hmm.
and it was nighttime.
Rain and the wind chill and everything.
Dude, that's insane, bro.
Yeah, and that's a thing that's been attributed to his disappearance and death, is that they said he just died because, you know, no one could survive that.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't even know how he would survive that, right? Like, -69 degrees is just such a huge drop in temperature. Like, and especially when you're flying through that, rain's hitting your face, rain's hitting your hand. Like, who even knows if his suit was really, like, protecting him falling down? Like, he was probably soaking wet.
Yeah, you know? 69 is not a good number in this situation.
No, the only time we don't like it.
Yeah. But dude, can you just imagine, like, put yourself in the shoes of the flight attendant? Like, you're just in the cockpit wondering, kind of scared, you know? And all of a sudden, like, the aft air stair light comes on. And then, like, there's a change in pressure, and you're like, oh, he's doing it. You know, like, he's doing it, and then he's just gone.
That's insane.
And then she didn't leave the cockpit, and they didn't leave and check out the cabin until they landed, like you were saying. So If he jumped at 8 p.m. and they landed at 10:15 p.m., that's 2-hour window that they're just flying, and he's gone. He's long gone.
And that also is a good window for searching, because it's like, now you have to backtrack 2 hours of, like, a plane flying at 115 miles per hour. Mm-hmm. Like, that's 200 miles you now have to search.
Yep, totally. Like, and if he's a skilled parachutist, which he was, is what they say, you know, he could have landed anywhere. Like, there's a huge area they would have had to search. So, and that's what we're going to hop into next. We're going to hop into the investigation and the aftermath of DB Cooper's jump. So the official description of Cooper has remained unchanged and is consistently considered reliable. Flight attendants Schaffner and Mucklow, who spent the most time with DB Cooper, were interviewed on the same night in separate cities and gave nearly identical descriptions. He was around 5'10", around 180 pounds, mid-40s, with close-set, piercing brown eyes and swarthy skin.
Swarthy.
Three major pieces of evidence were left on the plane when DB Cooper jumped: his black clip-on tie, a mother-of-pearl tie clip, and 8 filter-tipped Raleigh cigarette butts. So he'd smoked 8 cigarettes in this time.
I don't know the answer to this, but did they have strong enough DNA testing back then?
I don't believe so, no. I don't think DNA testing became big until the 80s.
All right, so they had no use for those.
Because OJ Simpson was the trial with... Ooh, OJ Simpson. We'll have to do...
OJ.
We'll have to do OJ on another show. But OJ Simpson's trial was the one where they really started doing DNA evidence a lot. And so...
And he's a fucking chain smoker, dude. 8 fucking cigarette butts.
8. Yeah, 8 cigarettes in just a matter of like an hour or two.
Goddamn.
That was also in the glory days of flying, when you could, you know, get bourbon and soda, smoke a cigarette, and flight attendants wore short skirts.
The dream, the patriarchy, what we live for. Fucking white
men. That's crazy. That was just 40 years ago. It's insane.
Yeah. All right. Do you want to know, Ben?
Go ahead.
Yeah. So only 4 pieces of evidence linked to DB Cooper have turned up since 1978 all the way to 2017, AO 3 years ago. November 1978, a placard printed with the instructions for lowering the aft stairs of a 727 was found by a deer hunter near a logging road about 13 miles or 21 kilometers east of Castle Rock, Washington. So that's intense. And then,
dude, that's pretty damning evidence.
Yeah.
Like, because one of those placards is going to be inside of a plane, and that's not just going to fall out of any random 727. That's going to have to be from DB Cooper's.
Wait, when we're talking placard, what does that exactly
mean? It's like it's a little plastic, usually information thing. You know, like the non-smoking signs, like that are posted on the plane. Those are placards.
Damn, he wrote on that.
Yeah, so it's like a little tiny.
So it probably just fell off the plane.
No, he probably ripped it off and was looking at it to open the aft staircase.
Yeah,
and then when the thing opened, the thing probably got sucked out.
Shit. Okay.
That's my guess.
Okay. All right, let me hop into this next one. So in February of 1980, 8-year-old Brian Ingram was vacationing with his family on the Columbia River at a beachfront when he uncovered 3 packets of the ransom cash as he racked the sandy riverbank to build a campfire. The bills were significantly disintegrated, but still bundled in rubber bands. The FBI technicians confirmed that the money was indeed a portion of the ransom, 2 packets of $120 bills each, all arranged in the same order as when given to Cooper. To date, none of the 9,710 remaining bills have turned up anywhere in the world. Their serial numbers remain available online for public search. The Columbia River ransom money and the air stair instruction placard remain the only confirmed physical evidence from the hijacking ever found outside the aircraft. That's gnarly.
That's crazy. And it was just a couple of the bills. Two packets of $120 bills.
Why do you think they were like significantly disintegrated? Do you think that was from the fuel burners in the back of the jet?
No, dude, just time. I mean, this was in 1980, so that cash had been 9 years already at this point. out in the open.
That's true.
Out in the open and the weather and all that. So, you know, it's money. Okay. It's paper. It's going to disintegrate. So I think it was just time that did it. And then in 2017, group of volunteer investigators uncovered what they believed to be potential evidence, which was what appeared to be a decades-old parachute strap in the Pacific Northwest. That was followed later in August 2017 with a piece of foam suspected of being a part of Cooper's backpack.
No. Dude, this is 2017. That's like not even long ago.
No, not at all. But like, you know, you find a piece of foam in the woods, like who would just be like, oh, this is DB Cooper's backpack?
True. What is this like? Is that 37 years after?
Yeah, that could literally be anybody's backpack. They just want a piece of the action, I think.
Dude.
I don't know. I think the evidence, the legit evidence is the placard and the money for sure.
Yeah.
The parachute cord, possibly. I feel like, though, if you found a piece of parachute cord, you'd find the whole shebang. You'd find the body. You'd find everything.
Well, and also, like, I don't know if the parachute strap would be realistic, because this is, like, 2017, that's 57 years after the fact. Like, this has got to be, I mean, how many people like to paraglide? How many people like to do,
you know, tons.
Like, could be tons. Anyone's parachute strap.
Tons. So, the money, I'll get behind, because, you know, it's proven that those were the serial numbers, and the placard, obviously, definitely evidence, because there's no way just a normal placard like that would be found in the woods.
Dude, what if, like, okay, so I'm just kind of, like, thinking this through, because I think it's kind of funny that there's 9,700 bills lying somewhere that can never be used. Like, this would be the ultimate heirloom if your grandpa just one day is like, hey, Sonny, come sit on my lap and let me tell you a story. And he's just like, I've got fucking unusable money. I'm literally James Bond. I jump from a plane.
I'm a millionaire, like, but not.
And then, yeah. And they're like, bullshit, grandpa. Like, show me. So he's like, all right, let's go down to the basement. Opens a chest, got all this money in here. He's like, look up that number for this dollar bill. Pulls it up. FBI registry pops up. Shows that it's DB Cooper. Well,
and we're going to get into that with some of the suspects. And that's what's crazy. And what you're saying about with the money, too. On the documentary series I watched, it was actually really funny. So there was a guy, and you'll have to forgive me because I don't remember the guy's name exactly, but he leased a submarine.
What the hell?
I mean, we're talking about this normal farmer in Washington leased a little mini sub and cruised around lakes all over Washington trying to find DB Cooper's body and money.
No.
He went bankrupt leasing this submarine. And he spent decades looking for it.
This guy was obsessed.
He was literally obsessed. Like, dude. This guy leased a freaking mini submarine and explored all the lakes and deep rivers around Washington to try to find any evidence.
This is insane. Like
that's how gripping this story is for this guy.
Like, one, is he just that obsessed? Or two, does he think he's going to get to keep a portion of the money if he can return it to the FBI? Like, damn, just give me $20,000.
Well, they did. You know, this is one of the most longest unsolved cases that the FBI has ever had. I mean, this haunts the FBI still today that they weren't able to solve this. And the case was closed in, I believe, 2016 or 2017, but don't quote me on that. But I mean, it's just, it's crazy. The people that, like, this story is just insane. Like, it's just, it sounds like a James Bond movie.
Yeah.
It sounds totally fake, but it's real.
No, it legit does though. Are we starting with local police?
Yeah.
Okay. So local police and FBI agents immediately began questioning possible suspects, and among them considered more than 800. That's horrible. Of these, all but two dozen were eliminated from the investigation. There we go. An Oregon man named DB Cooper, who had minor police record.
Dude, let's just go straight there first. Like, if I'm a detective, that is some fine ass detective work. He's like, all right, step one, we're going to interview. It's like the Pink Panther, you know? where he's like, where the person gets shot in the locker room and the last words are, oh, it's you. And he's like, I want to interview everyone in Paris with the name you. That's like what this is right now.
I just love it goes from 800 to like 24 and then, all right, let's get DB Cooper.
let's go through 800 of these mofos. And finally, they're like, oh, there's actually a guy in Oregon named DB Cooper.
Dude, my favorite part about this is he has a minor police record. Just a minor police record. Like, what the fuck? All right. So he's one of the first persons of interest in the case.
You don't say. I wonder what made him go to the top of the list.
Nothing in particular.
It's that police record.
So he was contacted by Portland police on the off chance that the hijacker had used his real name or the same alias in the previous crime. He was quickly ruled out as a suspect. That's so funny.
Dude, I can't believe that. I mean, they have to go through all the channels, you know, so I don't blame him for that. But it's like,
yeah,
it's like he's top suspect number one.
Dude, I wonder what the first question was. Like, they pulled D. Cooper and they're like, all right, hello, D.B. Cooper. Did you do it? Just yeah. Straight away. Did you do yeah. it?
A precise search area was difficult to define due to estimates that Cooper's projected landing point changed considerably. An important variable was the length of time he had remained in freefall before pulling the ripcord. If indeed he succeeded in opening a parachute at all, neither of the Air Force fighter pilots saw anything except the airliner, either visually or on radar, nor did they see a parachute open. But at night, with extremely limited visibility and cloud cover, obscuring any ground lighting below, any airborne human figure clad entirely in black clothing could easily have gone undetected.
Mm, so that's definitely thoughtful.
Mm-hmm.
That's very thoughtful.
I mean, he was wearing a black suit.
Dude, that makes so much more sense now. I didn't really think, I thought he was just trying to like impersonate James Bond, but that definitely seems way more logical.
He's a Men in Black agent.
Oh, shit.
Dude, we gotta bring aliens into this. His alien buddies picked him up after he jumped.
Bro, can I, all right, I was just thinking about this while you were reading that portion, but like, oh my God, imagine being DP Cooper, like the actual DB Cooper, and seeing a news reporter saying that like DB Cooper hijacked a plane, and like being DB Cooper's yeah. friends and family and also saying that shit and being like, dude, what the fuck is wrong with yeah. you?
You go into, you're DB Cooper, you go into a bank and the teller's like, oh my God, you know, like, Jesus,
life. Like, starts calling 911. Dude, this guy's gonna live a miserable life. Everywhere he goes, he's gonna have the cops called on him. Uh-huh. Like, oh.
You know it.
The trauma this guy's probably gone through.
Poor guy. Just change your name. let's see.
All right. So precise, right?
Sure.
Okay. So in a later experimental recreation, Scott piloted the aircraft used in the hijacking in the same flight configuration. FBI agents pushing a 200-pound sled out of the open air stair were able to reproduce the upward motion of the tail section described by the flight crew at 8:13 p.m. Based on this experiment, it was concluded that 8:13 p.m. was the most likely jump time. At that moment, the aircraft was flying through a heavy rainstorm over the Lewis River in southwestern Washington State. Sorry, I was like busy just reading it to make sure everything came out clear, but what were they trying to recreate? Just him jumping?
So they had a 200-pound sled because with him and the money, it would have been about 200 pounds.
Okay.
And what they're trying to recreate was the exact moment he jumped with a parachute to find out where he would fall exactly. Or oh, so they could narrow down a search area.
Gotcha.
But like with the money that the FBI is spending trying to like dude, they've spent 40 years on this case.
Yeah.
They have FBI agents doing all this bullshit, like pulling money and stuff out of a plane, recreating a plane and the flight path and all this and stuff. Like, at what point do the costs of investigating this just outweigh like bringing him to justice and just saying the guy was a badass, mad props, bro. See ya. Have a good day. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like 40 years of investigating this. And I guess justice, you know, justice, it's an okay thing. And like they're trying to get this guy, bring this guy to justice, but it's money.
Yeah.
It's money that he hasn't even used yet.
Well, it's invalidated money. You can't even use it. Just reprint it. Just say those dollar bills never exist anymore. Reprint it. We do that shit all
exactly,
the time.
Exactly. Exactly. Like, it's not like he killed anybody. Yeah. I mean, he did technically he didn't really like hijack a plane. He mostly just threatened them to fly it wherever he wanted to, which I guess that is kind of hijacking, skyjacking.
Hunter over here thinking about hijacking a plane.
but I'm like, at what point do you just say like, okay, you know, good job. Yeah. You're done. Just keep the damn money.
Here's your Eagle Scout badge.
For real.
Dude, like
the hijacking Eagle Scout badge.
Well, then that's the thing is like, I agree with you to the extent like this is just ridiculous. Like they're overspending, they're wasting like taxpayer dollars. But the one thing that kind of frustrates me is like, we're basically like saying this guy was able to get away with it, right?
Yeah.
And what message does that send to other hooligans?
Yeah, you're right. And it's there. They have to do their due diligence and they can't just like close a case because it's cost too much money. You know? They're going to constantly keep, I know, like if let's just say that DV Cooper's body washed up on a shore in a lake in Washington or something, or they found more money, I guarantee you the FBI would reopen the investigation.
Yeah.
Guaranteed.
They'd have to, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah. All right.
So we're going to go through some of the suspects now. And I really like this portion because these people are all so interesting. And like, it's almost kind of humorous, some of these people like, that they thought that was going to, that was DB Cooper. So the first one is Dwayne Weber or Weber. Joe Weber never suspected that her husband had a double life, but came to learn that there were many things about his past life that he did not tell her after she began investigating him following his deathbed confession in 1995. Reportedly, his final words were, "I am Dan Cooper," which meant nothing to Joe until she mentioned it to a friend who told her of the case of DB Cooper. And like, I'm sorry, in the 90s, how the hell do you not know about this guy?
Yeah.
You know, like he's like the most infamous, like Robin Hood, James Bond ever, you know, yeah. Like him saying, "I am Dan Cooper." And she's like, "What?" You
know? Just a what? Woman that doesn't listen. That's what it sounds
who
like.
Who is that?
Woman that doesn't get out much.
Right. So Joe Weber, she finally learned that the man she knew as Dwayne Weber or Weber had a lengthy criminal record and had a number of fake IDs, ID cards among his personal papers. The wallet in his car had a fake Florida driver's license and in the name of John Carson Collins, the name reportedly used when he was serving time in prison. Dwayne also had an old knee injury, which he claimed was acquired when jumping out of a plane.
Oh.
And a recurring nightmare where Joe said he would talk in his sleep about leaving fingerprints behind on a plane.
No way.
I'm sorry, but like, dude, this wife is a dumbass. Like,
yeah.
How do you not know about your husband's criminal record like that? Like that he had served time in prison, that he had jumped out of a plane, that he had all these fake IDs. Like, how does that just go unnoticed?
Dude, she's got to be not self-aware, because how do you not pull, like, he even admitted he had a knee injury from jumping from a plane, and then in his sleep, he's constantly talking about leaving fingerprints. Like, just put two and two together. That's it.
Dude, she didn't even know who DB Cooper was, though, so this broad is probably not, like, the sharpest.
Well, the thing that gets me is, like, this is really funny, because, like, who wouldn't want to like fuck around with their significant others as they're dying? Like, if you know you're dying and you're in good yeah, sound mind, yeah, why would you not be like, "I am DB Cooper," and then just pass the ghost? Like, that's funny as fuck.
I'm Saddam Hussein. I'm George W.
Like,
nice this, to meet you.
This actually inspired. I did not touch her there. I did not have sexual relations with that woman.
Nice to meet you, Bill. I'm George. Fool me once, shame on you.
Fool me twice. Fuck, how's it go? Fucking man.
Right though, like,
dude, but like, this inspires me, because now when I die, I legit want to be lying on my bed, be like, "I'm DB Cooper," even though I was born after you fucking did that shit.
Your wife is gonna be like, "Shut the hell up."
She won't know about who he is too.
I'm like, what?
What? I had no idea.
So, I mean, what do you think so far about this Dwayne Weber? What do you think about him so far?
I don't know. I think it's plausible. I already have my suspicions, but I'll save it till the end.
Yeah, and he's dead, so it's not like, I don't know.
Yeah. All right, I'll go into the next one. LD Cooper for all the Coopers. It can't be DB. It's got to be LD Cooper. All right, so in 2011, Marla Cooper went public with her belief that DB Cooper was her uncle, Lynn Doyle LD Cooper. Marla recalled that LD disappeared after Christmas, 1972, and that her father would be vague whenever she asked what happened to him. It was Christmas 1995 when Marla's father admitted that LD had been in hiding since he tried hijacking an airplane. This stirred memories from Marla's childhood, and she remembered seeing her uncle LD drive at her grandmother's home in Oregon on Thanksgiving Day, 1971. Barely conscious and in a blood-soaked t-shirt, muttering about how he had hijacked a plane and how all the family's financial problems were solved. It is hard to believe that DB Cooper, who was so meticulous and not leaving evidence behind, would use an alias so close to his real name. Additionally, apart from Marla Cooper's accounting, there is no other evidence linked LD Cooper to the case, and LD Cooper isn't known to have had any specialized training or knowledge DB Cooper demonstrated during the hijacking. That's Dude, an interesting that's, one.
I like that one a lot.
Yeah.
I feel like that one's more plausible than Dwayne.
It's definitely, yeah. Well, the blood-soaked t-shirt muttering about hijacking a plane and solving their financial problems. Like, there's a motive.
Exactly. And that's another thing that's crazy about, like if this family was in debt, and let's just say the family is $200,000 in debt, and he just really wanted to solve the family's financial problems. Because, like I said, the guy's not asking for $10 million.
Yeah.
The guy is asking for the equivalent, the time equivalent of a million, just barely shy of a million.
Yeah.
So that's a interesting point to make, I think, with this. Another thing is L.D. Cooper. If he actually went by L.D. Cooper.
Yeah.
Like, that's crazy to me.
Well, low-key, yeah, that's where I think, I don't know. Kind of ironic because, like, he seems like such a smartass, but then why would you be so stupid to literally
to use your last name?
Yeah. Mm-hmm,
for sure.
So that's fishy. And, like, really, like, honestly, I like how they put it with him being so meticulous. Like, you can't be that meticulous and that stupid at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way. So I almost want to just throw that one out, but it's way more believable than the, who is it, Weber?
Yeah, I think we can rule Weber out. But, you know, I don't think L.D. Cooper would, from the story that we've told and said, the guy sounds like a genius.
Yeah.
L.D. Cooper doesn't sound like a genius.
No.
Our next suspect is Richard Floyd McCoy. He was a devout Mormon Sunday school teacher.
Hey-o!
And engineer who served in the National Guard. Richard Floyd McCoy was the sort of outstanding citizen few would peg as a potential criminal. Most Mormons are.
Yeah.
Yet McCoy was a criminal. Most Mormons are. No, I'm just kidding.
I mean, they all hide it. It's just an interwoven society of crime.
White collar crime, though. Yet McCoy was a criminal who skyjacked a Boeing 747 flying from Denver to Los Angeles, diverting the plane to San Francisco, picked up a $500,000 ransom along with four parachutes. He sent the plane back up after refueling with instructions to fly east and bailed out of the plane in mid-flight near Provo, Utah. This occurred on April 7th, 1972, roughly 5 months after D.B. Cooper's heist in the skies between Portland and Seattle. So, maybe it's like, you know, he got away with it once, and now he's trying to get away with it the second time.
Wait, so one thing I want to hop in here and say, like, one, I really do think people go out there to, like, do things for the thrill. Like, I have a motorcycle. I do that for an adrenaline rush. And obviously, that's just going to keep getting elevated. I wonder if this guy had elevated his, like, need for adrenaline to this point. And then after he had successfully done it, he's like, damn, that felt fucking good and could get nothing close to it. So he had to recreate it 5 months
later. You almost feel untouchable. That's a lot of serial killers get that as well.
Like, yeah.
They feel they can get away with it so much that they just think that by the time they get caught, they're in such shock that they actually got caught that they're in denial of being caught.
What? That's crazy.
Yeah. So that's really interesting because now he's upping the stakes in multiple ways. I mean, he's skyjacking a 747.
That's a bigger plane, right?
It's massive. It's those two deck planes.
Oh, shit.
Like, it's three times the size of a 727 flying from Denver to LA. And he's asking for $500,000 now rather than $200,000. So he's upping the stakes where he's flying into much busier airports, he's stealing much bigger planes, and he's asking for a lot larger amount of money.
I wonder, what if this is the same guy and he's asking for $500,000 this time? Well, no, actually, that's more because he asked for $200,000 originally. Never mind.
And this is only 5 months after D.B. Cooper's first heist.
Yeah, why not up it? Because, like, if he literally needed something to fulfill that adrenaline rush, he would have to recreate it, if not do more.
Yeah. So what happened to Richard Floyd McCoy is that McCoy resembled the composite drawing of D.B. Cooper.
Okay.
And he also had military and survival training when he served in Vietnam. He was so he had the skills and the ability to survive such a event. He also had the tenacity to break out of prison twice after being convicted of the Denver skyjacking. And he finally died in a gunfight when FBI agents attacked him in July 1972. So, I mean, this guy sounds like a very smart guy. If he can break out of prison twice, if he can successfully, if he is D.B. Cooper, successfully do that whole stunt with a 727 and then finally do it again on a 747.
Yeah.
I don't know. To me, the skills match up with this guy.
Well,
the MO, not so much, you know, like, but the skill set that he has being a paratrooper in Vietnam, I mean, he obviously would have a deep knowledge and understanding of that kind of stuff.
So I'm going to go ahead and go out on a limb and up to this point say it's him. Just because, like, if you think about us being raised Mormon, right? Like, Mormon men wear suits and ties. Like, you try to look good. And obviously, if you're in shape and if you're a good-looking man, like, you can really pull off, like, a good, like, fashion if you, you know, have the right suit. So just going back to, like, D.B. Cooper and how he looked like a James Bond of sorts, you know, it wouldn't kind of blow my mind if this Mormon dude was trying to, like, replicate that image because he's Mormon. And, like, you know Mormons, like, I'm sure when you got your first suit when you went on your mission, because I know when I got my first suit when I went on my mission, like, I thought I looked good in it. I was like, this shit
is, for sure,
like,
yeah. It's a suit gives any guy really good confidence.
Right.
Yeah.
So I'm like, why could this not be the same guy? He was Mormon, so he definitely had that same thing we went through when it came to suits. And then also, there's no case if he's killed in 1972, 5 months after the first one. Like, he's gone. Like, what are you looking for? Like, if it was really him trying to up the ante and, like, get that same feeling he got from the first hijacking, like, I don't know. I see it kind of.
Yeah, I mean, there's very strong parallels to this. And I guess I'll kind of wait till the end to give my thoughts on the whole McCoy thing. But McCoy was questioned regarding D.B. Cooper's crimes after he was captured the first time.
Okay.
But he refused to confirm or deny anything. I can neither confirm nor deny
that I had sexual relations with that woman.
While the FBI officially declared McCoy skyjacking a copycat crime, the similarities in MO and other physical evidence have convinced many of the investigators who looked at McCoy's case that he was the man called Dan Cooper. While the mystery of D.B. Cooper ends without taking a stand, the evidence it presents regarding the idea that Richard Floyd McCoy was D.B. Cooper proves the most convincing. And there was that quote from the documentary we watched a little while ago, and it basically said the FBI agent that killed Richard Floyd McCoy said, "When I killed Richard Floyd McCoy, I also shot Dan Cooper."
Oh my God.
At the same time.
What a hick, bro. Like, I can just imagine the whitest person saying that.
Yeah.
The whitest.
Dude, he probably was so, like, trigger happy too that he was just like, "I just killed D.B. Cooper,
yeah,
and I also killed Richard Floyd McCoy at the same time."
He just wants to be a badass, bro. He's got too,
like,
much adrenaline.
Everybody's like, "How's that possible?" Because they're the same person.
And I'm a god. Killed both of them.
Uh huh. And, you know, so there are a really, really, really long list of suspects. Barbara Dayton's one of them. She was the trans woman that they suspected as well. We're not going to get into those because I personally just think there's a huge significant lack of evidence and MO surrounding them.
Yeah. And also people were racist and sexist and transphobic and phobic of everything back then.
Mm-hmm. So I just think that these top three are the most likely suspects out of everything I read. So I really like the Richard Floyd McCoy. And obviously this guy's got some balls of brass if he's going to hijack a 747.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
That's my opinion. I think that it probably was Richard Floyd McCoy.
Yeah, no, I agree. I just think really with the suit and everything, it just ties into Mormonism so well. And then on top of that, like, he's already done it once. Why not do it again? And he did, if this is the guy. My only other suspicion is that there's a cover up, because I feel like all these stories could always be a cover up, right?
Yeah. And I mean, maybe he's not even doing it for the money either, because I think that it either was Richard Floyd McCoy or D.B. Cooper died.
Yeah.
Because none of the money was spent. Like, I'm sorry, if you have that amount of money, you're either going to go international and cash that and put it in a foreign bank account. That's what I would do personally.
Mm.
I would take all that money, fly to Switzerland, put it in a Swiss bank account.
Would that not be tracked, though? Because even though it's international money, wouldn't they have to, like, register that that's being input into a bank?
It's hard to tell. I don't know if in the 70s that would be a thing.
Okay.
But I'm just saying, you would not want to risk spending that money in the U.S.
No.
Because immediately you'd be arrested. Whereas if you were to do it international or some places, like, you know, if you were to go to, like, a third world country with that kind of cash, I'm sure you could easily exchange it under the table for pure gold.
That's true.
And that way there would be no tracking. And then you could come back with that gold or, you know, go to another country and put it in a bank account.
Wait, which was one of the suspects that had gold on them too? Was that the Weber or Weber?
Yes. Yeah. The silver bars. I think he had some silver bars. It doesn't say it in our show notes, but yeah, he did have some money in his bank account.
So Dwan Weber could be still a suspect if they did cash it in for bars.
He would have to be extremely smart in order to figure out all that, though. Like, because I feel like your average person, after getting that money, would immediately go and use that money. Yeah. You know, that kind of cash would burn a hole in your pocket. Even if it was all just $20 bills, it's like, oh shit, I have a duffel bag full of $20 bills. I'm hungry. I'm going to go use one of those $20 bills to get a pizza, you know?
Yeah.
And then immediately, bam, you're screwed. You're caught.
Hmm. Well, I am curious because Dwan Weber, like, he's got that case of, like, having so many fake identification cards.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and they did interview him, right? So how did they?
They did not interview him. He was on his deathbed, remember?
Oh, that's right, because then he says, I'm Dan Cooper.
So,
dude, okay, I'm in a tie. It's got to be Dwan Weber. Or
and freaking, you know, that would be literally the secret of the century. Like, if you are Dan Cooper and there's this huge investigation and you're on your deathbed and you just say it with a smile on your face right before you die, I mean, that you would have to get that off your chest before you die. I personally would have to.
Yeah. Well, and also, he's 60 at this point. In the 70s, well, this is the 90s now. That's not like... I mean, that's a,
so the timeline matches up with him being in his mid 40s in the 70s. But you're right. Like, that kind of secret would destroy me mentally. If that was actually me, I would have to get that off my chest.
Yeah.
You know, maybe even it would be cool if he like wrote a secret book and then he told his wife, hey, publish this book after I'm gone.
Oh shit.
Dude, that would be awesome. Dan Cooper. And then he could just leave his wife all the proceeds of that book.
Fuck.
That'd be sick.
Dude, there's no way the FBI wouldn't take the proceeds. Like, fuck this guy. We're taking all the money.
This is going to pay back all the time we spent searching for this bastard.
Dropping 200 pounds off sleds.
Right?
Oh, my God.
So, anyways, do you have any final thoughts with what... I either think that... But now you've got me a little confused because, you know, like I said, these suspects are all very convincing.
Yeah.
If you dive deep enough. But... He also could have been just this guy that took the money and died. You know, he could have died when he jumped.
Yeah. I think naturally, like if we just read through these, like with the order we did, Richard McCoy, because we ended with it, is very convincing. But also there's a lot of crazy Mormons that get too much credit for being criminals. So I don't want to give him or Mormons any more credit than they deserve as being psychopaths. But like Weber, with saying he was DP Cooper, having fake identities, having a knee injury from jumping out of a plane, worry about his fingerprints being on a plane before DNA became a thing. Because
And his wife is daft.
Yeah.
She really didn't even notice anything that was going on.
And having silver bars. Because I think your logic on exchanging the money for like under the table, you know, gold or silver bars.
You'd have to do it. That's the only way you could get away with that kind of money.
Yeah.
Is doing a transaction into either gold or silver or... Like I was saying, foreign currency.
Yeah.
That's the only way you could ever get away with using that money in the States.
Right. So I don't know. It's got, I would say Weber, man. Unless.
All right. All right.
What do you think?
Like I said, I'm. Dude, I don't know. I'm going to go with McCoy.
McCoy.
Just to be different. But I think you have a good argument. And I think all these have a really good argument. Even LD Cooper, man. Like.
Yeah.
There's some really, like, if that's coincidence, that is scary.
Dude, well, also,
the similarities.
Why
to
did
it.
He have a blood-soaked shirt?
Maybe when he parachuted, he might have hit a tree and it punctured some of his skin.
Yeah.
I mean, because if you're parachuting into the woods and it's pitch black outside and it's rainy, you're obviously going to be falling at a faster rate of speed.
Yeah.
And if you, like, land straight on a tree, you're going to get messed up with, like, branches and stuff.
That's true.
So.
Dude, this is rough because, like, with this, I mean, is it just where the FBI got down to these three suspects and they were able to, like, convict one? Is that really what happened? Because
they are
all so damn convincing.
No, man. They never convicted anyone of this.
Right. But, like, do you think they couldn't make a conviction out of these three just because they couldn't get it rounded down to one? So it could have been one of these three. Like, it has to be.
Yeah. I mean, it could be, but it also could be a mystery man that died.
True.
Or... He didn't die, and he's just out there somewhere still. He's really old, but he's still out there. He could be in another country doing shit. You never know.
That's wild.
So, anyways, listeners, we want to know your thoughts, too. So if you want to send us an email, darkthingspodcast@gmail.com. You can also send us a message on Instagram. Let us know. If you are Dan Cooper listening to this show, we would love you to support our Patreon.
And send us a silver bar, too, for the shout-out.
Right. Well, we promise to keep your secret.
We won't tell anyone.
We'll help you write your book. How about that? But anyway, so yeah, this is the Dark Things Podcast. We're closing up season 3. We'll be back next week with season four. We're really excited about season four. We're going to open the show with Jonestown, Jim Jones. We're excited. He's one of my favorite cult leaders, so we're excited to talk about him. Once again, though, thank you for all your support. Give us a follow on Instagram or Twitter or Facebook. Send us a message. We're also going to be recording our first Patreon show, so if you do sign up to our Patreon, we would appreciate that very much. We're going to try to make some really funny, really interesting quality content for our Patreon, so if you're interested, please sign up and subscribe to that. Once again, this is Season 3, Episode 10, our season finale for Episode 3, D.B. Cooper, also known as Dan Cooper. Have a good week.
See ya.
Hey, hey.